and forth in those, or how the state law may want to change a little to be much more defensive.
Well, I'm not positive that I'm tracking what you're asking me. And I mean, one thing that the proposed new corporation code would do, which is not found in the other one, the existing law, which I think would be an advantage to anybody concerned with corporations, is it standardizes time requirements on notices to shareholders. Notices must be given a minimum of 20 days prior to the corporate action that you propose to take, and it cannot be more than 60 days prior to the corporate action. It's abusive if you wait until the last minute to mail something to someone knowing they're not going to get it. It can be equally abusive if you mail me something 6 months ahead of time as an invitation to a party, for I shall surely lose track of the date and lose the invitation and won't show up. So the Act standardizes that, and you don't have, whereas the current statute has different time frames for different actions, and people have to worry about whether this is a 10 and 50 day requirement, a 20 and 50 day requirement, there would be standard requirements, and I think that will make life a great deal simpler. With respect to proxies, the Act does not attempt to substantively interfere with the legislation that Elizabeth was primarily responsible for. It does clarify the nagging question of when a proxy is irrevocable. It says that proxies have no life beyond 11 months, so that no one can sit there and say, well, I have for a second annual meeting your proxy. The proxy cannot last beyond 11 months. For periods of revocation, it ties them to specific interests and makes clear when it is that that proxy can be revoked. It clarifies such things as that if the proxy person who gave the proxy actually shows up in person at the meeting, the fact that she's walked in the room revokes the proxy and she can vote her own shares. I mean, a lot of questions which at the present time are left in a sort of vacuous state. We don't know the answer in Alaska. An attorney, or indeed a far better idea than an attorney, a director of a corporation or a shareholder or an officer of a corporation could look at the law and read it and say, yes, if you come to the meeting, you can vote your shares in person. It also says that if you've given more than one proxy, the proxy which was given last in time controls. I mean, it is a much more detailed provision than existing law in those areas. But it does not deal with the disclosure requirements. What the new Act would do is to make it easier for shareholders to gain access, meaningful access, to the books so that they could see who the other shareholders were, where they lived. It streamlines the circumstances under which shareholders have a right to inspect those books, and I think it puts in meaningful consequences if they are denied those rights.
The thing is, the question that John raises goes sort of to the to, as I say, I think the center of the conundrum. As long as we assume that what we've got is almost, if you like, a closed system where you're dealing with native shareholders, that anything that is pro-shareholder rights tends to be something that most of us would be for and say in the long run would be for the health of the corporation. For example, I recall that in the present proposal, there is a proposal to remove directors without cause. That is a pro-shareholder provision, and that is a pretty good corporate governance. But it's a pro-shareholder provision. It's not a pro-management provision, and that works fine as long as we think of the fact that the corporations would have native shareholders. But what John is raising, and the part I you know feel I'm stumbling over, is the question of if you have in some fashion alienable stock, and you begin to see the encroachment of others and your balance within your shareholder community is shifting, then how do you start to rethink these things? For example, if I'm setting up a bunch of anti-takeover devices, I'm not talking about now within the native community I'm trying to help one native faction over another native faction. That's not what I mean, but I'm trying to help natives within Bristol Bay keep control over those other guys. What the heck am I doing having a provision that's required by state statutes that says directors can be removed without cause? Because everybody knows that one of the nice devices for retaining native control and director control is to have staggered terms. And so you have this, it's a tension, and he's shifting the time frame on us. We're fine as long as we're thinking everybody's within the native community.
And that's the same issue I brought up on cumulative and non-cumulative voting. We're continuing to back ourselves into the position of protecting a minority when in fact in 7 years that may be the worst thing in the world to be doing.
Yeah, well, could I,
but in that context, I would point out to you that the pending Alaska legislation on cumulative voting does not make cumulative voting mandatory, and it makes it something which depends upon the provisions of the Articles of Incorporation. In other words, there's great stress under the proposed statute in the content of the Articles of Incorporation, and those articles can be amended. But in order to make those changes, one would have to amend the articles, which does require shareholder participation, and it requires telling shareholders the truth under your proxy rules as to exactly what it is that's being proposed, and you have to count the ballots both for and against the thing.
I knew there was something I left out.
one matter on proxies that you ought to be aware of, which startled me when I read it, under existing Alaska cooperative corporation statutes, proxies are not allowed. You can't vote by proxy in a cooperative corporation.
So you have to have everybody.
Well, now here's that's whether you are thinking of this as good news or bad news, the telegram is not over. That is 10.15.130. You can't use proxies, but you can submit to shareholders for decision by written ballot any proposal. So you can use ballots, but you don't have the specter of my going to you and saying, Tom, let me have your proxy so that I can attend the annual meeting and cast it. Ballots can be submitted, which you then mail in, and we have to open the ballots, and then we have to count them. But nobody can walk into the room and say, I have the right to cast 60% of the votes of this business because the proxies are in my purse. It doesn't work in co-ops in Alaska.
Could I just ask you, Dan, to comment on what Elizabeth said about the directed proxy? That is, if management sends out a choice between co-ops and IRAs, or is it this or is it that?
Yes.
She said that, the only thing that you can do if you're soliciting proxies is get the person to actually mark his X on the choice he favors. That's a directed proxy. So it is the same thing, really, as a mail ballot, exactly what the law requires of cooperatives. Do you agree with that?
Yes, although, as I understand it, and I have not read the proxy rules, if they are like the federal proxy rules that are sent out, you have to give the shareholder one of three choices. If you give a proposal, you have to provide for the shareholder to vote yes or no, or the shareholder can simply give the proxy solicitor a blank power to cast the vote as that person chooses without directing the person at all. But you must give the proxy giver the right to preordain how you're going to vote on that. And I assume that's what your state statute does as well.
Okay, the proxy regulations provide that if you're sending out a proxy where there's going to be the choice between approval or disapproval of a certain matter, that you must provide boxes for the shareholder to make that choice. Now, what usually happens, too, is those shareholders who choose not to make that choice, and here it's not written this way, okay, and it's just following SEC practice, really. It's made up, if you like. It's not really in the state proxy rules. You can put in bold type below, you know, if Tony doesn't make the choice, this is how management will vote this proxy. I mean, you reveal right on the face of it how management's going to go if the shareholder does not direct it.
Well, tell me what happens, and I want to come to Claude because he has to leave, but let me just ask you this question, Elizabeth. If you've got approve or disapprove conversion of 40,000 acres of land to co-op or transfer to co-op, and management comes to a village and says, okay, we've got everybody to mark their choice and we're taking these back to the meeting. And then the dissidents, God forbid, they come along the next day and get them to mark one. Okay, it's the second in time that counts.
Right.
And then management comes back the next day and so on.
That's right, sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
Okay.
Because, I mean, why should only one side have their voice heard? I mean, that's just...
Claude, and then Claude has to leave in a few minutes. So.
Yes, I do. I'd like, before I leave, I'd like to add one more little element to this proxy discussion. Rose and I both have observed on one occasion, after the proxies were due by a certain date, at the annual meeting on the floor, a number of people picking up ballots after registration that were signed, mostly from the elders, because the elders didn't quite understand the issues, and they trust somebody to vote for them. Now, my understanding of that practice is that that ballot in that type of a practice, just a signed ballot on the floor, in effect makes a proxy. Is that correct? And is that legal?
You mean the elder is there in person?
Elder's there in person, but doesn't vote the ballot. Gives it to another and just signs the ballot. The ruling under that situation at that meeting was that the time and the due date for proxies had passed, and that a ballot on the floor could not in effect be a proxy. However, they were still voted, they were still ballots.
I think if I were carefully handling such a situation as that, and I had, say, myself at the meeting and Dan's at the meeting, and we wanted to integrate our, you know, each of us had the power to vote, I don't care whether it's our own shares or some other people's shares too, that what I would do is make sure that Dan was in the same room with me, and I added our numbers together and figured out what would be to our advantage, and I explained it to Dan, and Dan did his own voting. Because theoretically what somebody's doing by giving you the ballot is saying, you know, I want to contribute to your side. Well, that's fine, but I think the purest way to handle it is to say, you know, Dan and I should be together in the same room and figure it out, and I'll show him what I think's good, and Dan can say, yeah, I want to vote that way or not, and he marks it. It's his ballot.
Okay, that did not occur in this particular instance. My question was, after the due date of the proxies, that ballot in such a situation indeed turned into a proxy of a certain kind on the floor, an undirected ballot.
Rosemarie, did you want to add something to that? You have to
add to what Claude was referring to. The shareholders present at the meeting were approximately 300, so you could say that this practice had a substantial effect on the election of the directors at that meeting. The elders, most of them did not understand the voting system, and so they gave their ballots to someone they trusted that would vote the way they felt was good for the corporation, and it had a substantial effect on the voting. There, it wasn't just, you know, 10 people. We were talking about hundreds of people.
Yeah. I understand exactly what you're saying, and I understand that it would. I've certainly been at annual meetings. In addition to Bristol Bay's, where it's had an impact, I've seen other annual meetings where it's had an impact. And I'm just saying to you what I know. I'm not answering your question, but I'm saying the best practice would be to avoid, again, I'm in preventive law, but to avoid the question you're raising by gathering the people who are pro one side or another, whatever side that is, and see what numbers you've got, figure out how to vote it, and ask the people to vote their ballots that way. That would be the best way to do it. And the trick is to make sure that as you're having your discussions, it's not infiltrated by the other side, who of course would be delighted to know how you're doing your cumulative balloting, okay?
Yeah.
But
Tony and Marlene and then Dan and David, forgive me, I just, you're on this point?
Yes, exactly on the point.
Yes, go ahead then.
As I understand the proxy regulations or the rules about voting, and perhaps I'm perceiving it too closely to a corporation I used to work with on proxies, is that the rule on proxy voting is that they have to be, that you can vote by proxy or show up at the meeting in person. So that these people who showed up in the meeting and were there in person, regardless of how their ballot got to the ballot box and was placed in it, they were voting in person. They'd gotten a ballot, they'd signed off for it, and when they walked in the door, the elderly people, and if they were at the meeting in person, then they in fact voted in person rather than by proxy. So although they in fact themselves did not place the ballot in the ballot box, they were voting in person because they were present at the meeting. And that's how they became a participant in the annual meeting. There's a couple other smaller points that I wanted to address, something that Daniel was talking about, or Elizabeth I was talking about earlier, and about when the annual report has to be provided to the shareholders in their casting of their, or before you start requesting ballots from them. As I understood, again, this is really a nitpicky point. I guess lawyers have a license to do that. And that is that my understanding of the rules requires that the annual report not be mailed out after the request for proxies, so that they can be both mailed out at the same time, but they can be mailed out at different classes of mail. The annual report might get there perhaps 2 weeks after the proxy request gets there.
The case law had dealt with that, and therefore SEC, I think, even wrote into their proxy regulations, which even this lawyer felt was a bit nitpicky, but that you had to, if you were going to send them out at the same time, you had to send them out by the kind of class of mail that meant that the proxy wouldn't get there, you know, 2 weeks before the annual report. Fair is fair, again. And I think even without the rules, if an Alaska court saw an obvious policy of a management to be cute and send out, the annual report by pack mule, but to send out the proxy by a plane and hand-delivered, the Alaska court would do something.
There was one other small point about the location of shareholders, and this really addresses Tom's earlier question. I don't know if it was answered fully by Elizabeth, it might have been, but on setting up a ballot box in a community, it would be real difficult in some respects to do that for some corporations, because I know at Sea Alaska that having managed that process for them for a couple of years, that some of our shareholders, I certainly remember one of them being in Oslo, Norway, and another one being out in Bangkok, Thailand, and it would have been rather difficult.
You wouldn't be willing to travel there with
I'd
the ballot
love
box?
To. I'd love to.
Wait a minute.
The only point I'm asking you to think about, not now but in the future, is this. You had an election here last week for president, pretty important decision, and everybody cast one ballot. There are no proxies and so on. Well, thanks for coming, Claude. And Rosemarie, if you have to leave too, thanks for coming. Marlene, you had a point to make.
I was going to speak to the general election just held, which there was a lot of interest because of a number of local races also. And in our area, we had what we considered a fairly heavy turnout, and we had 59.5%. In the village I'm from, we had 60% even. And if you took the non-natives who voted, I would sure that that's about 100% of them that voted. You take the percentage of natives and shareholders, you know, you would have a much smaller percentage. And this was in something, you know, on something that was rather important to everyone.
And this was?
Yes.
That was
yes,
a good.
It was.
Yeah.
Yeah, we had a very close race for our House seat, which there was a lot of interest in.
Elizabeth, and then David, and then Dolly.
I just wanted to comment on the ballot box situation, because in living in Alaska for 10 years, as a matter of fact, I believe after this last general election, there was actually an editorial in the Daily News complimenting the state because at last they'd held an election that hadn't been challenged in the courts. In other words, the state has an elaborate and expensive machinery out in the bush for the ballot boxes, for the custody of those ballot boxes, for the custody of the ballots, for treating the ballots a certain way, for making sure that they're not altered, for making sure that they're not conveniently lost, et cetera. And I would just hesitate as a corporation to try to set up such a parallel system in each of the communities. I'm concerned, again, about preventive law, and we handle it by having them sent to the accounting firm that does the counting. So, for example, it does mean, and this was sort of established in one of the cases that, that Cook Inlet had, that it's very good practice to make sure that the non-management slates or the dissident ballots do not go into the corporate headquarters of the corporation, where they then, whether they are altered or not, you are vulnerable to that charge. So we just handle it by having, I don't touch those things, I don't see those things. You know, I see the numbers, and the numbers are produced not by our own staff, but by a third party who is paid out of the corporation's coffers. And it just concerns me, the idea there would be ballot boxes in each community.
David?
I guess it's fair to say that in the presidential election or the latest legislative elections, there's no disclosure requirement of honesty and fair play that we have with proxy solicitations, correct? my question really is, is there any...
An abstract
over,
statement.
David,
or
it's over. No. This leads to something, I hope. At the, is there any requirement for disclosure and fair play and all the rest for people who are voting in person at the annual meeting?
Basically, if you've done a good job in your proxy statement, which means you've revealed to the shareholders what's going to be voted on at the annual meeting, and you've disclosed to them the pluses and minuses of it, you've already disclosed what should be disclosed. And what usually happens at the annual meeting is people getting up and talking about their feelings. And since it's not, if you like, the solicitation of proxies, it usually doesn't seem to fall under the commercial speech standards, is my understanding. You have a little more flexibility.
But is there a disclosure requirement, though, whereby someone could challenge the vote at an annual meeting if it were strictly a personal vote by the members there and there were no proxies, let's say?
Well, I guess I don't, let's see. I will tell you the only case I can think of in this state was the Aleut case. And granted, it did involve the solicitation proxy, but it also involved sort of a letter, a chatty little letter from management on how well they were doing. And the judge basically said, and I thought rather nicely, that management had used a definition of profit, net profit, and how well they were doing that no lawyer, no accountant, and no soothsayer would use. Okay. It was totally out of whole cloth. And so basically the judge threw it out.
All right. Now, if we were having, Dan mentioned that there could be no proxy solicitations for co-ops, it had to be by mail ballot. Do the proxy solicitation requirements, or is there anything like them to cover ballots by mail for cooperatives, if that's the procedure that's used?
There's nothing in the existing Alaska Corporation statute on co-ops that deals with that topic at all.
Okay.
All right.
Dolly and then Tony.
I had a question on proxies. Is there a way that shareholders can develop their own proposal as a proxy? Say that Sean Seat chooses to do nothing but remain a corporation and is not interested in being an IRA or a co-op, and there is a large body of shareholders who disagree with Sean Seat's policy. Can they develop a proposal and submit it?
That's a good question.
I think the majority of the shareholders or the shareholders in such a situation have a couple of things they can do. The first thing they can do on the discovery that management or the directors in place are not presenting for their consideration the alternatives that they wanted presented, then that, of course, would become, if you almost like a platform for running an alternative director slate. and that one of the promises of the alternative director slate would be when we are in, we will present to you for your mandatory vote, alternatives A, B, and C, or whatever they are. That's one approach. The second approach is, it seems to me the shareholders could present a proposal, but at that point it would be, as I understand corporate law, just at the level of an advisory vote rather than the mandatory. Because to get to the mandatory stage, you got to go through the directors first and then to the shareholders. But it would be one of those things, I guess, I think Charlie alluded to it, that if you like, the board would ignore at their peril. I mean, if you got the kind of vote that you're suggesting, even though it would be an advisory proposal, it seems to me management would be forced to present to for your consideration. Management also, of course, could put out in their proxy statement the reasons they might be against the alternative and talk about it that way too. But you wouldn't be left without recourse, it seems to me.
Could I think that's a very important question, and I didn't altogether follow the answer. The management, if they decide to put the thing, go IRA, yes or no, you get your directed proxy. Now, if a group, a minority group in a corporation, were faced with a situation in which management refused to do anything, they said, well, we're a corporation and we'll take our chances in 1991. And they wanted to put, let us say, so many acres of land in a co-op or an IRA, they really can't do that. Is that what you're saying? They really can't put that to the membership, to the shareholders.
They can put it to the shareholders, but if they put it just straight to the shareholders that way, it seems to me it would just be maybe in the advisory posture rather than the mandatory. And this gets back maybe to the whole thing Dan, when he was giving the overview of corporations, talked about. By and large, certain decisions are left to the board of directors. One of the problems is that many of the organic changes, the initial thrust of whether to present it to the shareholders or not, is considered to be a board of directors decision. But I'm not suggesting that means the shareholders are without recourse. It means it just isn't as smooth and as clean. There are two alternatives of what you could do. One, you could follow a little along the lines Dolly raised, which is, if I were running a non-management proposal, I would do a proxy solicitation, I would do my proxy statement, and I would present whatever the alternative proposal was. It might be advisory, but I'm suggesting if I were to garner enough votes, that board would ignore it at its peril. That is one possible approach to take. A second possible approach to take is to say, darn it, we've waited for this board to move, and we've waited for this board to move, and we've waited for this board to move, and this is the third year I've waited for this board to move, and they have done nothing. I am going to run an alternate slate, and that alternate slate is going to be for these proposals, and I would explain the proposals and explain again carefully the positives and negatives of those proposals and get a different slate in, and that group would then have promised as part of their approach to present it to the shareholders.
An advisory proxy, say some shareholders started it and they developed their own proxy, what's to say that it would be a requirement of the corporation to even look at the proxy or to have it tallied or voted or anything?
it really doesn't matter whether I'm the one soliciting the proxy, whether you're the one soliciting the proxy. Those proxies are proxies given by shareholders. All shareholders have a right to be heard. Unfortunately, a lot of shareholders have forced me to recognize that when I didn't want to hear it. But there's no question that the corporation is obligated to take those proxies into account. And the only way they could successfully ignore them is if somehow they were able to launch an action with the state and say that you had solicited them in under false and misleading circumstances and get the state to void them, okay, which is a different kind of action, but they just can't slip them in the drawer and ignore. I mean, it is illegal for them to just slip them in the drawer and ignore them.
Okay, if they develop their own proposal and proxy, could they also develop their own dates? Just say, okay, I'm going to send these to all the shareholders because I'm really angry with management. I'm tired of it. I'm going to send it out to them. I'm going to give them self-addressed envelopes so they could send them back. And that, can they decide the date, okay, then on January 1, we're going to open these proxies, we're going to count them, and if management's out, then management's out.
Dolly, would you run that for me a little again?
What Marlene said was you have to call a special meeting, but would that be necessary? Could they just vote all the proxies by mail and send them back into the corporation, and with that proxy solicitation on that proxy say, okay, this proxy is for option A or B, and that these proxies will be opened on such a date.
I see.
And create their own date rather than waiting for the corporation to create a date or a special meeting.
I've got it now. Thank you. As I understand it, what you're talking about is can you hold sort of a plebiscite any date you want? And usually, the whole purpose of proxies is that they're voted or counted or come into the hopper, into the picture at a shareholders meeting, which means you must have a shareholders meeting. And this could be your regular annual meeting, which follows a cycle, or if it's something the way you're talking about, you could go through the right procedures and Dan, maybe you remember this, I don't, the steps for shareholders forcing a special meeting to be called. I've lost those in the past, but what percent? 10% of the shareholders? Why don't you fill that in, Dan? But am I saying that right, Dolly, that it's got to be tied to a shareholders meeting?
Okay, I'm sorry. Tony, were you next? And then David has a point he wants to raise.
Yes, I somewhat related to this, the issue of independent proxy solicitations rather than any other term that likes to be used.
The dissenters?
No, independent. It makes no political statement, just independent.
Right, okay.
I'm curious, I need to ask both either Dan or Elizabeth about this one issue. Can a non-shareholder collect proxies as an independent and go in and cast them, solicit them from shareholders, and go in and be authorized to go in and cast them at an annual meeting? Even perhaps have his or her campaign, obviously disclosing it to the shareholders where he's getting his campaign funds from. I'd like an answer to that, and if depending on your answer, I want another follow-up question on it.
I think both Dan and I would agree that in general corporate law, the answer to that is yes. A non-shareholder can be a proxy holder. However, because of the nature of native corporations, many have struggled with that very issue. Not only the issue so much of shareholder versus non-shareholder, but even narrowly the issue of native versus non-native. Maybe the person is a shareholder but a non-native, or maybe the person is a native and a school teacher in the area but a non-shareholder. You know, the various corporations have struggled with that and come out with different cuts, Tony, and as to my knowledge, there is no case law on it. I will tell you that in our corporation, the way I ended up slicing it, I do not suggest to you that it's the right way. I ended up slicing it by say, what I cared about, rather than substituting my own judgment for the person, the native shareholder, chose to vote his shares. If he wanted to choose a teacher who was non-native, who was coming to the, you know, to town to the meeting, why should I substitute my judgment for that? So I said that you look to the beneficial ownership of the shares, and if that, in effect, who the shareholder was, and if that shareholder was native, he himself, and an adult, he could choose any proxy holder he wanted. But other native corporations have sliced it differently. Do you see? And yes, they put it in their bylaws.
Yes, I understand that now. That does bring to mind another scenario, and I'd like to have it responded to, and that is. And this really goes towards corporate takeovers and native management of the corporation, or at least native perception of having some kind of control over what the general population of natives having control over what the corporation does. And that is I'll paint the scenario. A non-shareholder has a desire to go in and bring in a bunch of new directors running an independent campaign and to replace all of the board slate, and is able to obtain from a developing company, an oil company or whatever, a substantial amount of dollars to do it. I know in campaigns, proxy contests, it could amount to about $10,000 per individual independent trying to get on a board of directors, $10,000 expenditures for the campaign. Say they were able to get a war chest together of for six candidates, $60,000 or $80,000 to stick on or to run a real healthy campaign. Those people who they're getting to be their candidates have made a promise to the developer, the oil company, I will open up all of our lands for you to make sure that you have an access to it, and we'll make a deal. And they disclose that to the shareholders. We have Sohio backing us in our efforts to have our slate. Is there any response to that? It seems to me that's possible under existing law.
Oops, I picked up the Monroe Prize technique. I think that's not only possible, but I think that the protection you have, such it is the fact that the money backing has to be disclosed. Again, in the Siri case, when Bruce Kendall was financing and backing, and it just happened that Bruce Kendall happened to have an outstanding lawsuit with Siri, and he was, of course, in great hopes that if the people he backed for the board won, that lawsuit would be dropped. So he was financing it, and the court clearly held disclosure, and you're saying there should be disclosure. I think that at least so far, and it may change in the future, but if we were to talk as of today, I think in the Native community there would be a lot of hostility toward somebody who was running for the board with Sohio money backing them. Or a proxy holder gathering proxies with Sohio money backing them, whether that person was native or non-native. And if you add the non-native in to top it off, I think you've got a real losing combination there. I don't think that the solicitation would be successful. I may be wrong, but I guess I'm just speaking out of a gut feeling of what I see.
I wasn't trying to decide whether it was a native running or a non-native, even a shareholder who's running for as an independent and being the proxy holder can actually use that procedure and end up without with somehow indirect control by a fairly large corporation who's put together a committee to elect.
Absolutely, and as I say, at least the protection exists right now for disclosure. I think there's always been the threat and always the fear that there would be straw men, that there would be natives who would agree to pursue the interests of other interests than whatever they themselves personally think or what they think in their own convictions is for the good of the whole, and that there's always been the fear that as the honeypot gets more desirable, that there would be strong.
Yeah, I brought that up because to me, it's that kind of indirect control can take place whether it's an IRA or a nonprofit or a cooperative or a corporation.
I agree with you, Tony. As I say, the only thing I can think of is the fact that there's the disclosure to some degree does cut against it. Unless somebody's doing the fraud thing, which is what Bruce Kendall tried to do.
Well, Daniel Fessler was really kind of reaction there.
Well, I think that we shouldn't equate all of the forms. I think I don't know about the IRAs. I mean, that's why the rest of you are here and Ralph's here to disabuse me of a huge void of ignorance. But of the three that you're talking about, profit-seeking, nonprofit, and co-ops, it would seem that the co-op would be the one that would be naturally the hardest one to subvert. Mm. First of all, because under the Alaska Corporations Code, there's no requirement that the directors be shareholders.
There is an ANCSCA.
There is an ANCSCA, but I mean, if at some point those things begin to expire and the ANCSCA corporations begin to be treated more and more like regular profit-seeking corporations, Under the concept of nonprofit corporations, there is no requirement in state law that the directors have to be members. But there is a state law requirement that you can only have members as directors of co-ops. And I mean, you can have puppets, but just looking at the three candidates for state law, which is the hardest one to subvert from without, would be the co-op.
Also leads us into, I would like to hear more discussion now on the issue of conflicts of interest.
Could I, just before we do that, Tony, David Case wanted to raise a point about disclosure of the value of land, if land is going to be transferred from the native corporation to an IRA or a co-op or something else. Given what Elizabeth has said about disclosure, David, do you?
Well, after CONIAG, is the problem with valuing native land simply an unleapable barrier to effective disclosure?
How about a yes-no answer?
Yeah, right.
Okay. Remember in the CONIAG case, one of the things that was going on were some of the shareholders in village corporations who, if you, you know, took some kind of educated guess on the value of what they would be giving up per share by this merger going through, because it was one of those one share for one share mergers. In other words, there'd been no effort by the management of CONIAG to do an appropriate share exchange ratio. After all, if you've got a dollar in assets and I've got $5 in assets, and you come to me and you say, Liz, let's put them all together and we'll each walk out with an equal number of shares, I might do it, but it's nice if I know that up front, because there might be some other things in the equation. You've agreed to manage the assets for both of us, and so I say that's a fine deal. But in the CONIAG situation, what happened was that many of the shareholders were not aware that they were giving up much more value than they were receiving, although they were receiving the same number of shares back. Now, if I understand what you're proposing, or what, you know, some of the discussion's been going on a transfer of land to another entity where the quote-unquote parent itself wouldn't own the entity, but rather the shareholders would own the entity, you in a way have a different posture. You, I think, would have to disclose things to the shareholders. You might have to disclose things about the difficulties of management or the greater or lesser degrees of protection that were involved in the new entity. But maybe it's arguable that value isn't the issue, because the shareholders aren't losing some kind of value. It's being, to use the favorite phrase today, transformed, transmuted, converted, but it's, you're not somehow changing the value so that you have a lesser thing.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if we could have a little discussion on Tony's point about conflict of interest, and then there are some folks here representing shareholders in prison that wanted to say a few words on their behalf. I think they're still here, but maybe we could spend a few minutes on Tony's point about conflict of interest.
If you wish to pose the question, Councillor, I'll strive to answer.
I'll try to restate it as I understand it, grow over time, because I've having worked with and been at a lot of shareholder meetings, it seems invariably the issue of conflict of interest comes up in this regard. There are village corporations that have operations and they own the surface estate, and the regional corporation owns the subsurface. There's village corporate, I don't know how that's relevant, but there's village corporation directors who are also regional corporation directors, or there are village corporation officers who are also regional corporation directors or officers. In other words, there's with a limited number of talented bodies out there, there's going to be inevitably a group of people who are in conflicting and playing conflicting roles, and I don't have an easy answer for that kind of situation. I don't know if there is one.
The question of a conflict of interest is very vexing, and one of the biggest problems with existing Alaska corporation law is there are no statutory provisions on conflicts of interest. And so we begin without guidance, which is found in the law of most other states. The conflict of interest problem arises from an assumption, which is a common law assumption, that a director owes to the corporation on the board of which he or she sits what is called both a duty of care and a duty of loyalty. The conflict of interest is primarily a manifestation of the common law idea of a duty of loyalty. The director is supposed to deal in exercising the authority of the office of director in such a manner as the director in good faith believes is in the best interest of the corporation and is to be guided by no other perceptions of interest or advantage in making up his or her mind, so that the director's loyalty is owed to the corporate entity, not to the shareholders that elected the director, not to the family, not to any certainly not to any personal advantage which the director might perceive is being obtained, but is owed, in theory, to the corporation. Well, how can an individual serve on the board of two corporations? And if those, well, there is no problem so long as the two corporations do not deal with one another. But if the two corporations deal with one another, and I happen to be serving on the board of each, how can I, on behalf of the corporation that is the buyer in the transaction, devote my single-minded loyalty to seeking out terms most advantageous to the buyer, while at the same time acting as a director of the corporation that would be the seller, those terms which are most advantageous to the seller in what is essentially an adversarial negotiation? Right? Now, as I say, Alaska law doesn't solve the problem, and that is that's a great difficulty, because a director worries about the potential of being accused and sought to be held personally liable for violating a standard which is articulated in some after-arising judicial opinion. The proposed provisions of the Corporation Code pending in the legislature, which will be reintroduced in January, contain provisions which you'll want to look at, Section 478. Section 478 is entitled Director Conflict of Interest. It divides conflict of interest into two categories, what are called conflict